With Valentine's Day right around the corner, today we check in with Eli Finkel, author of The All or Nothing Marriage.
Around 1850 or so, you start to see a movement where people start to care a lot about personal fulfillment, that as marriage became, it went from an institution where people were workmates to an institution where people are soulmates.
More about modern marriages and how to make them better. Plus, a Stephen Sondheim musical about presidential assassins is at the University of Illinois. Here's director J.W. Morissette.
What does it take for somebody to reach the point where they feel assassination is justified, whatever their worldview may be? What does it take to get them to that? And the musical aspect sort of opens us up a little bit for that.
And we continue our series of interviews with candidates for Attorney General. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. With less than a week left before Valentine's Day, we thought we'd kick off your weekend with a little lesson in good relationships. So we've called in a professional marriage doctor. Eli Finkel teaches in social psychology, management, and organizations at Northwestern University. And his latest book is called The All or Nothing Marriage. Every Valentine's Day, he takes over the official Northwestern Twitter handle, that's Northwestern U, to answer questions about matters of the heart. You can also use the hashtag AskFinkel. And in the latest cover story of Chicago Magazine, he takes readers inside his marriage lab, where he helps people think a little differently about their spouses. He's with us now at our studios at Northwestern University at the Medill School of Journalism in Evanston. Eli, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the idea of analyzing relationships or marriage therapy, is this also solely a modern conceit? Did people in other eras worry about the quality of their relationships to the way that we do now?
Oh, nowhere near as much as we do now. I mean, one of the things that I find useful when I think about what marriage used to be like is I think about Abraham Lincoln's upbringing. So he was born about 200 years ago in 1809. And he was born into a one-room, dirt-floor log cabin. He had an older sister, and the four of them lived there together. There was another kid that came after that but died in infancy. When Abraham was 9, his mother died, and when he was still a teenager, his only remaining sibling died, giving birth to a stillborn kid. And I don't mention that, just for the sheer joy of it or even because it's such a distinctive story, but life was precarious, fragile, a couple hundred years ago. And so when people thought about what they were going to prioritize in a marriage, it wasn't this sense that we're soulmates or I want to marry you because you're my best friend. They married for very practical things, literally things like food, clothing, shelter. Those are the sorts of things they used to prioritize.
And you write about this, right, in your book, The All or Nothing Marriage, kind of tracing the pathway of how we came to what is sort of the modern American understanding. And you also talk about this. Do you think it's fair to say that we put more pressure on our marriages and relationships now than we used to, in a way? Because at one point, we're talking about survival, and that's obviously kind of the biggest pressure you could put on a relationship. But I feel like, how have things changed?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. It's not really so much that we expect more today, exactly. It's that the nature of what we expect has radically changed. So as I was saying earlier, the idea, you might sort of kiss someone and go off to work or whatever else, the unit of economic production was the individual farmhouse. Both the husband and the wife worked together. It was like a dual person, one career household where they were just barely scraping by, and you better hope that locusts didn't ruin the crops this year. But over time, we've increasingly cared about more emotional and psychological sorts of needs. And so starting really with the rise of industrialization and, say around 1850 or so, you start to see a movement where people start to care a lot about personal fulfillment through their marriage. And in particular, at least during that era, the major thing people prioritized was love. That as marriage became, it went from an institution where people were workmates to an institution where people are soulmates.
And then that said, what do you think you're learning that people want from their partners these days?
Yeah, so with industrialization came this emphasis on personal fulfillment, and we still have that today. But one thing that's interesting is starting around the 1960s, we no longer thought that a love-based marriage was sufficient. So We still care a lot that we love our spouse. There's no question about that. But these days, in contrast to, say, 1850 or 1950 even, it's not strange to hear somebody say, look, you know, he's a wonderful man. I love him very much, and he's a good father. But I feel stagnant in this relationship, and I'm not going to stay in a relationship like that for the next 30 years of my life. And so these days, we do still care about love in the relationship, but we also care about something more, something that revolves around self-discovery and personal growth. We want to be with somebody who brings out the best in us. And those sorts of expectations are interesting because they're very difficult to meet, right? So, and for this reason, the average marriage has actually been getting a little worse, because a marriage that would have been fulfilling for us in 1950 falls short of our expectations today. But it also has an upside, which is when you're shooting for that additional type of connection, you place within reach the possibility that you'll achieve a level of marital connection that was unavailable in an era where people weren't even trying.
Right. So that must be why you write the best marriages. You write this in your book. The best marriages today are better than the best marriages of earlier eras, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. As the expectations shift and in fact rise with regard to these emotional and psychological sorts of needs, more marriages are falling short because of those lofty expectations. But at the same time, the marriages that are successful in meeting those expectations are fulfilling in a whole new way.
My guest is Eli Finkel. He's the author of The All or Nothing Marriage. Let's talk about, Eli, some potential solutions for marriage and relationships that may not be the best. And I should point out, you're not a therapist or a clinical psychologist, but what happens when couples come to your lab? Can you walk us through an example of what people might experience?
Well, we do a broad range of different types of studies. Here's an example of the sort of work that we do. We ran one multi-year study where we studied married couples, and we followed up with them every 4 months. And every 4 months, they wrote about the biggest conflict they'd had in their marriage over the previous 4 months. And then we randomly assigned half of the couples to do an additional writing task, an additional 7 minutes of writing, that asked them to think about that conflict from the perspective of a neutral third party who wants the best for everybody. And what that procedure does is it gets you outside of your own perspective and helps you look at the relationship as a whole. And what we found is that people who did this additional writing task tended to have marriages that were, again, not radically stronger, but statistically reliably stronger than people who hadn't done this additional writing task, this additional task of thinking about things from the third party perspective. And so these are the sorts of studies that we tend to do in my lab here at Northwestern.
Well, and then you also sort of write about this. You write about love hacks, right? There's not quick fixes for every marriage, as you point out, because not every marriage should be saved. But there's one example you write about, and I wonder how much this gets to sort of the writing you were talking about, these couples doing celebrating together. Why is that an important thing for people?
So savoring successes is something that we as a field of research, like relationships research, we have underappreciated this for a long time. And I think that people in general underappreciate this stuff. We often talk about things like social support. So, you know, can I rely on you when I'm going through a difficult time? And in fact, if you think about when people actually get to a clinical therapist's a marital therapist's office, for example, it's usually when things are pretty dire. But we need to evaluate the quality of our relationships, not just in terms of normal versus bad, but also normal versus really good. And one of the things that we can do that can take a marriage or help to take a marriage from, you know, relatively okay to quite strong is being good about savoring achievements together. And if you wait until it's a monumental achievement, somebody gets a PhD or you have your first baby, right? You just won't be celebrating often enough. So couples that are pretty good about recognizing day-to-day sort of achievements, the sorts of things that might happen every, I don't know, week or two or maybe three or four, right? Regularly enough that you can crack a bottle of wine and say, you know what? This warrants a toast. Those people tend to be better about savoring things in their life and consequently enjoying each other more.
Eli, you mentioned kids. I wonder, when people come to you seeking advice, how often are kids involved in the mix?
quite often. I mean, you know, there's a lot of research about what the major areas of conflict are in relationships, and there are things that you might expect: money, kids, sex. Kids are complicated. They certainly are bundles of joy, but they're also bundles of sleeplessness and bundles of spit up and bundles of diapering. And so the arrival of the first kid tends to be a pretty disruptive moment for the usually relatively young couple. And, you know, one recent estimate that I saw suggests that among dual income couples, the average amount of additional hours a week that people are now working, if you consider the care of a child work, is about 33 and a half additional hours. And I guess I would say that's per week, by the way. And I guess I would say, you know, among your listeners who don't have kids, you know, where would you and your partner, you and your spouse, find those 33 and a half hours? And if you had to find 33 and a half hours to do things that are, yes, very loving and warm and nurturing, but also a whole lot of washing bottles and cleaning up spit up, you know, do you think you might fight a little bit more? And the answer probably is yes, if you're like most couples. Do you think you might have a little bit less sex than you used to? Well, if you're like most couples, the answer is yes. Do you think you might have fewer conversations that are deeply connective? Well, if you're like most couples, the answer is yes. And so I think one thing that's effective for a lot of couples is to lower expectations about the quality of the connection for a little while the kids are very, very young. And then once you're sleeping through the night again, you can get back to some of that more aspirational, high-level expectation of the relationship.
You also mentioned sex, and I feel like that's another big component, I imagine, of what people talk to you about. And I wonder, do you think that, is it the physical intimacy or the emotional that you think most people find lacking?
I mean, I think it's probably on balance equally both. Sex is linked to a lot of positive outcomes in relationships. I mean, you know, it's a little bit complicated to disentangle the causal direction because relationships that are good tend to promote more sex, and then more sex tends to promote relationships that are good. But yeah, one of the dangerous things that happen when things get chaotic in a marriage is, or in a relationship more generally, is we make less time for those little things that bring us together, the sort of connective tissue of a relationship. And one of the strongest forms of connective tissue in a relationship is physical intimacy, including, and perhaps especially, sexual intimacy. And, you know, sex, when it is going well in a relationship, is about as good as anything in terms of making the couple feel close and connected to each other.
I'm speaking with Eli Finkel. There's a story about him on the latest cover edition of Chicago Magazine, where he's taking readers inside his marriage lab. He's also the author of The All or Nothing Marriage. And Eli, what in your experience changes when we're talking about same-sex couples?
Not as much as you might think. You know, the slightly longer version of that answer is, I wish there were more research on this question than there's been, but the research that exists suggests that same-sex couples, so the work that has been done is on gay men, lesbians, and heterosexuals, and they compare those three groups. So there are, of course, other groups, and they have not been studied. But of the work that I am aware of in that space, the story is much more one of similarity than one of difference. And it turns out that just like heterosexual people, people involved in same-sex relationships like to feel loved and nurtured, and they benefit from having a good sex life, and they benefit from having a responsive, sensitive caregiver, a responsive, sensitive partner. And so you can focus on differences. For example, like the frequency of sexual contact is higher among gay men than among the other groups, and the likelihood of having an openly non-monogamous relationship is also a little higher among gay men than among the other groups. But by and large, once you're focusing on people who are in a relationship, the story of how people relate, the story of how the heart works, is overwhelmingly similar across the groups.
I wanted to ask you, Eli, your book came out last September, and a lot has happened in the past few months alone just in terms of women's identities. I'm thinking not just of the hashtag MeToo moment, but also of our changing political landscape. And I wonder, do you see marriages changing because of this? Are you working on any new theories about this?
You know, it is a great question. And I have to say, I'm probably among the many who is like watching and learning in real time. I mean, this is a massive social movement, particularly the Me Too movement. But I think you're right. The broader cultural context here, it seems to be that a moment of you know, assertive female empowerment, I think, and hopefully the breaking down of some barriers that we've seen for a long time about women's ability to get all sorts of things, including justice in the legal system. In general, what we see these days is that greater egalitarianism is associated with better marital quality. That wasn't always the case. So there was a period there in the 70s and the 80s where more educated women were less likely to be married and they were more likely to struggle in marriage, like marriage was more difficult. But that was an era where women had started to adjust to the new sort of gender paradigm that started in the wake of the, you know, second wave feminist movement. But men really hadn't started to adjust. So men really weren't doing a whole lot of additional work around the household. And, you know, as the generations have passed, so I'm 42, you could talk about my generation or even the generation after mine, men are increasingly involved in the home, and that helps to offset some of the additional labor that comes from women being increasingly involved in the workplace. And as those trends have continued, we've seen that now it is the most educated women who are the most likely to marry and who have the strongest relationships. And so my hope is that what we're seeing with some of the female empowerment that we've seen in the last few months is another step toward gender equality and toward a really equal marital paradigm that will be, in fact, beneficial and helpful for both men and women and children.
Eli Finkel is a social psychologist at Northwestern University. He's the author of The All or Nothing Marriage. And on Valentine's Day, you can also tweet your questions to him. He takes over the Northwestern University Twitter handle to answer questions about matters of the heart. Eli, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was fun.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, presenting a public history exhibit in the north-south corridor of the University of Illinois Main Library throughout the month of February, with highlights from a century in publishing and design. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
I did it because it is wrong for one man to have so much service when other men have none.
I did it to bring down the government of Abraham Lincoln and avenge the ravaged South.
I did it to prove to her my everlasting love.
I did it to make them listen to Charlie.
I did it because my belly was on the fire.
I did it to preserve the Union and promote the sale of my book.
That's audio from the 2004 Broadway production of Sondheim's Assassins. There's actually been 20 assassination attempts, 4 fatal, on the 45 men who have held office as president of the United States. And the Illinois Theater at the University of Illinois has a new production of The Assassins. It's an audacious musical, you have to be, if you want to set the story of presidential assassins to song. And it's on at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts for this final weekend. We've got the details up at our website, 21stshow.org. For those of you who aren't in Central Illinois or can't make it to the program, director J.W. Morissette is with us in studio now. He's also the assistant head of the Department of Theater at the U of I. J.W., welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So Assassins first premiered, this was in the 1990s, was the original production. What drew you to this now?
It's interesting. Thinking about the original production of 1990, there was also an incredibly successful revival of 2004.
But I actually, Neil Patrick Harris, which is the audio that we were just playing
right,
there.
Right, right. I was actually introduced to this piece way back when I was in college, so several years ago, before the original, just as the original production was coming out. And I became intrigued with the concept of that Stephen Sondheim and John Wideman, who worked together to create this piece, of bringing these assassins together. At the time, I was in an acting for the camera class looking at how television film works. And one of the things that we learned about scripts was that oftentimes for a TV show, you'll pick an interesting place, such as like Cheers, where there's a bar where lots of interesting people can come through so that you have a storyline that continues to develop. This sort of went in a different direction and took a lot of interesting people combined by a pretty horrific act and brought them together in one specific place. And that intrigued me a lot.
Well, when you think about it, and I hadn't thought about it until I saw the production, we do have sort of this morbid fascination. Americans do, probably every country does. But I think there is sort of this uniquely morbid fascination America has had with people who have tried to assassinate our president.
Yes, absolutely. I think it even goes further than that. I think there is one of the lines in the show always pops into my head when I start thinking about this is a line from The Balladeer that says, Lincoln, who got mixed reviews, now, because he was assassinated by John Wilkes Booth, only gets rave reviews. There's also a symbolic element that happens to this sort of fascination with the assassinations and the outcome and the afterwards and a sort of collective memory of where was I when I learned about this? What was I doing at that time? The other connection I have to the piece is really very tangential, but it was way back when I was actually just in fifth grade. I was asked to play for the Kennedy assassination anniversary. I was asked to play John F. Kennedy as a fifth grader and I actually got the part where they reenacted lying in state. So I got to be lying underneath an
That's
American
what you,
flag.
In fifth grade?
In fifth grade.
You had to play...
the body, essentially, of the president.
Wow.
But I remember learning all about the Kennedy assassination. And at that time, talking to my grandparents who had experienced it as adults and my parents who had experienced it as children, and the sort of universality of people's ability to recall the moment they found out united that storytelling. And of course, in a more contemporary sense, I think my generation, certainly we have something like the Challenger explosion, or we have something as unfortunate as the...
Which is just an anniversary of recently.
Right, yeah. Exactly. That these sort of epic disasters that indel themselves in our memory, they leave a mark. And when I learned there was a musical that talked about this same thing, I became really interested. It combined all the things that I was fascinated with.
I think that is an interesting point you make. And I was thinking about that in that line in the play that you mentioned about there's also something about the mythology of our country that when a president gets assassinated, we never talk about anything bad that happened in their presidency, which this production doesn't really focus on the presidents. It's really all the individual stories of the successful and unsuccessful attempts. But I do think that is the other side to maybe a little bit of the mythology that we have.
Sure, absolutely. I think the symbolic representation, I think, that is inherent in the office of the presidency, regardless of who may be in that office at the time, connects to an identity of America, be it stereotypical or be it non-inclusive. It still exists. And when we have lost presidents, you're right, there becomes a tradition of, while we may look back critically, we often exalt the person or the president that was lost in that process, and they become almost mythical in that. You can see that, not to give any spoilers away from the show, but we tie together the first successful attempt of assassin with John Wilkes Booth, who ultimately meets with Lee Harvey Oswald in a sort of imaginary scene to convince him to assassinate JFK. And that mythology is sort of handed directly onward and I think still continues.
So that's an interesting point because in a way I thought in the I was actually one of our producers and I were discussing this after we saw the production. He was saying, you know, it's kind of a leap of fantasy to see them all together. And I was saying, I actually don't think it is because there is a sort of legacy of the ghost of John Wilkes Booth that is whispering into the ears of all of these other people who decide to do this.
Absolutely. The interesting part for me is I came across a book called Assassination Vacation, which takes a look at some of the historic spots that assassinations were attempted in, sort of tongue-in-cheek look, but it's filled with some great history, and it's a wonderful read. And one of the things I realized was, while these folks seem to be disconnected by time, when we learn about them in history, they're under the title of assassin, and they're all lumped together in our history books. They sequentially usually start at the beginning and cover each of their experiences. And yet some of them are lost to us. I think we have a particularly Illinois connection with John Wilkes Booth and Lincoln. And one of the people that I think is lost to us a little bit is Charles Guiteau, who is a fascinatingly complex and often bizarre character from history that we don't learn a whole lot about. But we do in the musical. We get reintroduced to him.
And he's the one who he wanted to promote his book and become an ambassador to France.
He wanted to become the ambassador to France. There are records of him just showing up at the White House to demand that he was going to become the ambassador to France. And he has a whole, it is far too involved to go into, but a pretty sordid history of dealing with his identity, his interactions. They make some reference to it in the actual musical about last week he was a bill collector and next week he's going to be an insurance salesman. And I've often actually told the cast, I said, we need to do an Assassins Part 2, which just focuses on Charles Guiteau's life. It is filled with that much interesting information.
And so the tone of this, I think, is a fascinating one because it is a musical. And it does deal with there's some really dark moments in this also. There are executions. Everybody's walking around with firearms. When you were thinking about this staging, how did you handle sort of the tone and the juxtaposition of that? And of course, the fact that a lot of these people have mental illnesses. They're completely unstable.
You're incredibly observant to catch on to the idea that through a certain lens, musicals are sort of a bizarre creation. A group of people seem to be gathered, and then they burst into song, and they all know the same lyrics and the same music, and they all do the same dance, which, of course, seems completely absurd to talk about something as serious as assassination. But what it does for me is it first sort of makes just asking the question of what does it take for somebody to reach the point where they feel assassination is justified, whatever their worldview may be. What does it take to get them to that? And the musical aspect sort of opens us up a little bit for that. The other thing it does is that it makes the serious moments even more serious because we realized 2 seconds ago we might have been laughing at something that we thought was rather clever. And then we remember, again, the reality of what that action means and what the impact of those actions result in. And it heightens both sort of the kind of clever silliness that may exist, but also heightens the dramatic effect of what's happening. So we crafted for a very long time in the rehearsal process a way to make sure that we were, A, still being true to what the concept as we understood it from Stephen Sondheim's work, which is imbued with a lot of wonderful, clever, lighthearted moments, but that was mixed with the reality of who were these people. And I wouldn't say that somebody coming to see the show is going to get a history lesson on this is 100% accurate history, just by the fact that it's a musical. But the essence of those characters are still there. And all of the cast were doing research into the characters they were playing. And for many of them, it was an introduction to much of the history of those names attached. And in their characterization, in their work as actors, they have paid great heed to who those people were, and in some cases still are. Sarah Jane Moore is still with us, just recently released from prison, actually. So in some
cases... She attempted to kill President Ford,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
Okay, so she was one of a follower of Charles Manson?
No, that was Squeaky Frome.
Okay.
But in this musical, Squeaky, because she also attempted...
So there's my actual history getting the knowledge of that completely messed up by viewing of the musical.
And that's one of the clever takes, is to put Squeaky, who attempted to kill Gerald Ford, and Sarah Jane Moore, who just a few short weeks later also attempted to kill Gerald Ford, and we stick them together. So history is not accurately represented in the final outcome, but the essence and the story of what was there is still present.
And so as we're talking about this, that juxtaposition with John Hinckley, and there's sort of his kind of main song, Unworthy of Your Love, it's a really serious and kind of scary part into when he's talking about Jodie Foster and why he did all of this. And then you kind of hear that in this ballad. So I wanted to hear that and then sort of juxtapose it with the way that his actual attempt to assassinate Ronald Reagan is depicted.
Nothing. You are wind and water and sky. Jody, tell me, Jody, how I can earn your love. I would swim oceans, I would move mountains, I would do anything for you. What do you want me to do?
That's from the 2004 Broadway revival of Stephen Sondheim's Assassins, which is actually on at the Cranford Center for Performing Arts, production by the Illinois Theater this final weekend. Director J.W. Morissette is in studio with me here in Urbana now. So that's this song. And then the actual attempt, the assassination attempt, is kind of, it's funny.
Part of it is, what I have found generally to be true is if we seem to have contemporary knowledge or experience of the presidents that and they survived, Sondheim seems to have treated them with a little bit
of
a light
touch.
Right,
that's what I thought. I thought, oh, Reagan survived. That's why this is kind of,
right.
This is a lighter touch.
Well,
right.
And there are some lighter touches, but, you know, when we're talking about Garfield and McKinley, we're far removed from them. So I think there's a little more space, perhaps in Sondheim's mind, of what we're able to maybe make a little more fun of. But John Hinckley is certainly painted as a kind of isolated, disturbed individual. We have this Unworthy of Your Love song where he's claiming love for Jodie Foster, and in order to get her attention, he is going to attempt to assassinate Ronald Reagan. And I think the other part we get some lightheartedness is that Ronald Reagan was sort of legendary for his reaction to having been shot. We know that there were jokes on the table about hoping all of the doctors were Republicans and him making fun of Hinckley's inability to actually kill him. And now we have learned through history that he was far more ill than we thought. But I have very vivid memories of pictures of him standing at the hospital room window waving out to his supporters. And we know later that history has told us actually he was incredibly ill, and it was amazing that he was able to even stand up. But that was not what we saw at the time. At the time, it was about it didn't work, and the Gipper is still there for you. So,
and so when we think about this, it was written in the 90s. What additions did you make as an adaptation to our current day? I recall a pretty good Barack Obama impersonation for just the beginning for a little bit.
Well, let me tell you about that. We always have a sort of challenge in contemporary theater, in the modern theater, which is these wonderful cell phone devices that travel with us everywhere we go. And people forget to turn them off beforehand. And what we have sort of established as a norm is that there's a kind of disembodied voiceover announcement saying, please turn off your cell phones for the patrons. And we find that people tend to not even hear them and block them out. So we actually added what we call our pre-show announcement. Also for the audience's comfort, there's an opportunity to see that we will be using stage weapons.
I wanted to ask you about that in a moment.
And blank gunfire. But our actor, I said to the actor that's playing the proprietor, is the name of the character actually, who introduces us to our evening events, I said, why don't you go ahead and just see what you would write as the proprietor of the show to help the audience feel welcome and present. And the President Obama impersonation was something that he does pretty well. And he decided to give it a try, and he found a quote that really spoke to him. So he tied that all together. It's not really part of the show itself. Actually, we have made absolutely no alterations to the show itself from the version, the 2004 version. There was a song that didn't exist in the 1990 version called Something Just Broke. And the ensemble sings that right after the assassination of President Kennedy. And in the 2004 revival, they restored that song. It had been in the works, and it had come and gone from different productions over the years and finally became part of what is actually the legally licensed version of the show that you can perform in 2018. I think that song, Something Just Broke, is an important addition to the piece because, I can't prove this factually. If I had a chance to sit down with Stephen Sondheim and John Wideman, I'd love to have this conversation, but much of the kind of dramatic energy and fuel of the story comes from this ultimate assassination, which is framed as the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And as we have become more and more removed from that time period and have lost generations who have experienced it firsthand, this song, Something Just Broke, offers a sort of contextualization of the emotions of just everyday people about what happens when these tragedies occur. So while there is a little addition of Barack Obama, the body of the show is left exactly as it is meant to be.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about Assassins. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
What a wonder is a gun. What a versatile invention. First of all, when you've a gun, everybody pays attention. When you think what must be done, think of all that it can do.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. That is audio from the 2004 Broadway production of The Assassins. A local production of this is happening in Central Illinois. It's a production by Illinois Theater at the University of Illinois. Director J.W. Morrison is in studio with me. He's also the assistant head of the theater department at U of I. So there was something that we were just talking about before the break, which was the kind of disclaimer at the beginning about firearms. And certainly, I think everybody from the opening scene, everyone is walking around picking up guns. You know that this is going to be part of the show. How did you handle that? And your choices, were those actually like they're firing blanks? You kind of make a note about that at the beginning of the production as well. How was that a challenge?
Yeah, actually, it was a great challenge on several levels for us. So first of all, honoring what was in the script and what was requested of the script is there just are a lot of guns present in the stories and the actual histories. Guns make up part of that. In some cases, we fetishize those guns. They're in museums. We look at the gun that killed Lincoln and different weapons throughout history. So from a kind of multi-layered process, one of the first things is, and this is at the heart of what we're doing, is we're training the next generation of theater professionals. And having young students who have an opportunity to work with weapons on stage is a wonderful training process for them. So when they leave, they are ready for professional practice. They know what standards are surround them. And our violence coordinator and weapons master, Zev Steinberg, Professor Steinberg, has been working from the week before actually casting about how we were going to deal safely and instruct our students in the process of what the professional practices around the use of weapons on stage may be. The other layer is also what is the audience comfort? The show actually calls for over 40 gunshots in the show. And we have the wonderful privilege of being able to present Assassins in the Studio Theater, which is a smaller theater space in the Krannert Center. We don't normally get to do that with musicals. Musicals are almost always moved into the giant 700, 800-seat houses in a proscenium stage. To get to see this show in an intimate theater with just about 200 seats is a fabulous opportunity to see it in a different way. It's also a miserable opportunity to hear over 40 gunshots in a small space. So we found ways to cut that down. I think there are only actually 18 total gunshots in the show. And some of them are live and some of them are recorded so that we can control the volume. And we had over 8 different meetings at which we measured the sound volume of every single one of the types of shots that are available for the stage weapons. And these are stage weapons. They are not actual guns that have blanks in them or something like that. These are completely blocked and safe for stage use. But we brought in our audio technicians and our sound designer, and we measured the different volumes of each shot and came to the conclusion that essentially we have sort of cap guns on steroids in the space. So it's not overwhelming, and the audience isn't going to be completely deafened by the process.
After this, to the end of it, as I was thinking about this after I saw it, this was very entertaining, also incredibly unsettling because it's complicated and messy and horrible, which I think speaks to the power of theater and art when it's done well. But I wanted to ask you about the tone of this. Like, how do you see? Do you see this as hopeful kind of production about America, even though there's an irony in that of a people who, you know, this is the story of 20 people who tried to tear down the foundation of the country as well.
Sure. I see a great deal of hope in it because we're able to look back at the identity of the American dream and all the manifestations that it comes from. We had a great discussion with the entire production team just a few weeks ago. And one of the things that I can't remember which actor said it, but they pointed out that we started discussions about this show. This was over a year and a half ago, were discussions about this show. And one of the things that I had said at that time was that the Assassins are now historical figures and mythical figures that we look to, and we decry their terrible actions. We see them as awful human beings in some cases, and in other cases, perhaps people exalt them for the choices that they made. But fundamentally, they were Americans that had reached a point that said their dream was not possible unless this action was their next step. And when you remember that, we sort of talked about the fact that the assassins were of us and from us and part of us. And not saying that we're all assassins, but that these were people that seemed to be leading relatively normal everyday lives. I think
it's part of our American story, too.
Right, exactly. And that story is not told often. You know, the character of Czolgosz, for example, who comes from an immigrant family and is a working class person who meets up with Emma Goldman and the teachings of Emma Goldman and all of the politics that come with that. But ultimately, he was suffering. He couldn't make a living and he was frustrated and he didn't know how to make a better world for himself. And we don't advocate for the use of violence, but we do make space for the stories to hear what are some of those underlying things that were lost to sort of the sort of shiny American dream story of, you know, you can do it if you work hard enough. Well, sometimes you can't do it if you work hard enough. And what do you do with that? So ultimately for me, it becomes hopeful because we ask that question and there is a voice there and there's a lesson to be learned from that. There's a great line in the show where the balladeer sings, angry men don't write the rules and guns don't right the wrongs. And I think that's a lesson. There's a lesson there is that we think this will make a difference and we'll make some big splash in the news and this will ultimately change everything. That's not always the result of those violent actions. And I think it's a powerful reminder of that.
J.W. Morissette is the director of this production of Sondheim's Assassins, which is on for this final weekend at the Cranard Center for the Performing Arts if you're in the central Illinois area. He's also the assistant head of the Department of Theater at the University of Illinois. J.W., thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're continuing our series of interviews with candidates for Illinois Attorney General. The current Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, isn't running for re-election. There's 10 folks that are hoping to replace her. The primary is on March 20th. So here's how we did this. Like a job interview, we tried to ask each candidate almost the same questions, and we recorded all the interviews in advance. Renato Mariani is a former federal prosecutor. He's a native Chicagoan who's with the law firm of Thompson Coburn. He's a frequent legal commentator. He's one of 8 Democrats running for attorney general. Renato Mariani, welcome back to the 21st.
Great being here.
So our audience, if they watch cable TV, they might recognize you from this past year. You've been a frequent commenter on CNN and MSNBC talking about President Trump and his policies so far. Is President Trump the reason why you're running for attorney general?
Well, he's certainly part of the reason why. I mean, I think we're not living in an ordinary time. We're living in a time where we have a president of the United States who is attacking the FBI, attacking the Justice Department, attacking our court system, going after, immigrants and other, vulnerable groups, and is violating our constitutional rights. So we really need an attorney general who's going to stand up to Donald Trump. And attorney generals are really our last line of defense. I mean, what we've seen throughout the country is state's attorney generals standing up and taking action to try to limit or prevent harmful policies of the Trump administration. It's a big part of what I'm going to be doing. And, you know, it's a real opportunity to do something during a difficult time for our state.
I was going to ask you, that said, what do you see as the main role of the attorney general?
Well, I think the most important thing an attorney general can do is fight for economic justice. And here's what I mean by that. There are a lot of people out there who are struggling to make ends meet. People like my family. I mean, my parents didn't go to college. They both worked 2 jobs to put me through school. And people like that, they can't afford a fancy lawyer to fight for them and to file a suit when they've been defrauded or they've been harmed by a financial institution or their employer's not paying them the money that they're due. And that's why you really need an attorney general who's going to be, out there fighting for people who, frankly, need a lawyer out there fighting for them. And that's part of, that really ties into what we were talking about a minute ago with the Trump administration, because, that's really a lot of the same sort of thing, fighting for people, whether they're immigrants who are being deported by Donald Trump or they're people who are being discriminated against on behalf of by the Trump administration. You need a lawyer who's going to stand up and fight for you.
Apart from immigration and that discrimination that you mentioned, what priorities would you focus on?
Well, I think we talked a little bit about economic justice, and in particular, one one issue that I think is under focused on right now is something called wage theft, where people are just not getting paid the wages that they're due, not getting the overtime that they're entitled to or vacation time, or they're being misclassified. I would also focus on public corruption. I think that's an important feature as well. You know, we have a lot of people in our state that are unfortunately losing faith in their state government. And we need an attorney general who's going to, try to hold our politicians to a higher standard. I mean, as somebody, I'm not a politician, I'm not an insider, I'm not somebody like that. And we really need somebody in this role who's going to be an independent voice. And I think that's something that I can really bring to the table.
You also have a sizable social media presence, especially via Twitter, and you tweet a lot about the Mueller investigation and especially about President Trump. If you were elected attorney general, would you keep tweeting?
I would. You know, I think one thing that I've really seen as a citizen, I mean, I'm somebody who's, part of the resistance and one of these activists, and what I see is a lot of distance between our elected officials and people on the ground who are, have real problems and are upset and concerned about where our government's heading, both our federal government and our state government. And I think what we need is people who are going to be in touch with the people they represent. So, not only do I tweet all the time, but, I had a telephone town hall this week where we had over 150 people asking me questions over the phone. I go around, I've got over 60 events planned between now and Election Day where I'm just meeting with different groups of voters around the state. I really think that we need more direct communication between people in office and voters, not less. So I think tweeting, Facebook, those are great ways that I use to communicate with people. And frankly, I have learned a lot from the people that I talk to on those mediums. And it's frankly a big part of my campaign is my campaign, unlike others, is not financed by big checks. It's financed by small money donations from people that I've, gotten to know through Twitter or Facebook or elsewhere.
I'm speaking with Attorney General candidate Renato Mariotti. You're a former federal prosecutor. I mentioned that at the beginning. You took a leave of absence from that because of an illness that you had. How did that change how you approached your work?
Well, I think it's, changed quite a bit. I think that, whenever you are in a situation when you are facing a time where you think you may have a very serious illness that may cause death even, I mean, I was at a point where we were trying to figure out if I had ALS or something that would obviously be life-ending. It's always scary. It was scary when I was told I had cancer. I mean, I was afraid. And I think what it reminds you is that life is short and that you have to spend the time you have in life, not just planning for the future, but doing everything you can to make every moment count. And, when I left the U.S. Attorney's Office shortly after I got a clean bill of health, one thing that I set out to do was to make the most of the time that I had left. And that's when I started getting really involved, being an activist, being somebody who, during this time, I want to be able to look back on this time, very difficult time for our country, and say, look, I did everything I could to stand up to Donald Trump. I did everything I could to fight for what was right. That's why I'm doing this. I'm not somebody who's been plotting to run for attorney general for a long time. I'm somebody who, frankly, is just upset about what's going on in our country and trying to do the right thing.
That said, there's a crowded field of seven others who are running for the Democratic nomination. Why should voters choose you? They know why you want to do it. So why should they choose you?
Well, I'm the only person in the race who's not a politician, not an insider, haven't been appointed by Rahm Emanuel or by Mike Madigan. I am somebody who's not beholden to anybody. I'm not taking, contributions from special interests. My average contribution size from our donations is well under $100. We're funded by people like you. And, what you're getting at with what you're getting with me is somebody who's a great lawyer, who's tried a lot of cases, who's, investigated crime, but is not somebody beholden to someone, not somebody who's been trading favors in Springfield or elsewhere. You're going to get somebody in, the attorney general's office should be a lawyer's job, not a politician job. And you're going to get somebody who is a lawyer and who's independent and experienced and can bring that experience and will be looking out for your interests, not the special interests.
Renato Mariotti is a former federal prosecutor. He's a native Chicago, and he's now with the law firm of Thompson Coburn. and one of 8 Democrats running for attorney general. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
That does it for us today. Next week, we're taking the 21st on the road to our partner station, WUIS. We're going to be broadcasting in Springfield all week, beginning with a show Monday morning, President Lincoln's birthday, at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. So if you're in the area, join us. Stop by. We'll be there from 11 a.m. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.